Calling all small firm architects. It's time to tap into your full potential with Entree Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my two favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles and Katie Kangas, as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast. It's a community where dreams meet action.
There's a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success. Welcome back to Entrepreneur Architect, the podcast where architects learn to build better businesses. My name is Mark R. LePage, and this, my friends, is episode number 10. Osha Wilson is the founder of Boiled Architecture. She's a licensed architect in San Francisco, California. She holds an MBA from UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business, and she sits on the AIA California Council's Committee on Integrated Project Delivery. She brings a no-nonsense approach to her work, believing that architects and builders should put their heads together to get the job done. That's the description that she has on her website at boiledarchitecture.com, and she's launched a firm with the intent of doing things very differently. She recognized while she was working with other firms that the traditional structure of an architectural firm is rather dysfunctional. And she structured her firm to be efficient, effective, and pretty flexible. And I have a very personal interest in what she's doing because Anne-Marie and I are in the process of planning some major structural changes to our own firm, Five Cat Studio. So I invited Osha to come on the podcast today to explain to me and to everyone who's listening how she's structured her firm so we can all learn from her. So I'm going to let her do that, and let's get right into the conversation right now. Osha Wilson, it's great to be speaking with you today. Welcome to the Entrepreneur Architect Podcast.
Thanks, Mark.
Let's start with your origin story. Give us a brief introduction of who you are, where you've come from, and what you're doing today.
Sure. I'm an architect, and I've known since I was 12 that I wanted to be an architect. And I did everything right and went to college and got an architecture degree and got out of school and found my first architecture job, then my second. After a few years of working in architecture, I felt like I kind of had the lay of the land, and the lay of the land seemed kind of dysfunctional to me. I started asking a lot of questions with the people that I worked under about why we were doing things the way we were doing them. You know, why are we correcting this many mistakes? Why don't we have access to the builders while we're designing? Why are the contracts structured this way? And I kept getting a lot of non-answers. Like, they didn't either didn't know the answers, or they really hadn't thought about it and didn't understand why I cared to ask this many questions, or the answer was constantly like, well, that's just how we do things. That's how we've always done them. And that included the speed at which I was learning. I kept trying to understand more, you know, what does it mean to, how do we do architecture? And the answers that I kept getting were like, well, you just do it. And after a long time, you learn.
Right.
So, you know, at the expense of the owner. And you just make a lot of mistakes and then 10 years later, somehow you're competent. That just seemed really messed up. So a few years ago, I was working at a larger firm doing large projects for healthcare. And I just started really digging in to find the answers to these questions. And the answers seemed to keep coming back to the structure of the company, or the structure of the project team or the structure of the contracts. So, for instance, we were making, I was working construction contract administration for a few years, and I kept fixing all of these errors, like lots and lots and lots of errors, like a dozen every week. And when I would look into why these errors were occurring, I would find that they had occurred on the previous three or four projects, identical problems. And nobody had ever cycled back to the construction documents department to tell them about these issues. And that's because the company was set up in silos. And so the people who specialized in construction did not cycle back through construction documents. And there was no meeting of the minds or weekly, you know, download of here's what we fixed or any way to record these lessons learned. And so that was a flaw in how the company was structured that was leading to an actual, you know, a poor product output. And that's just one of many, many examples of what I kept learning was, wow, the way that you structure a company has a direct output, has a direct effect on the output, you know, the product. So I became really interested in that idea right about the time that I learned about integrated project delivery. And integrated project delivery, also called IPD, is about restructuring the way that the project team is contracted to each other, basically creating a different business structure by making them interdependent on each other. And then the output is better coordination. So this seemed like the same idea, but on a project team level, as opposed to a company-wide level. And so I started digging into contract structure and finding that I had a talent and an interest there that a lot of other architects didn't have. And that led me to think that maybe where my career might lead me was to understand architecture as a business. And that maybe that's where my talents lie. And so fast forward, I now have gotten my MBA from UC Berkeley. And so I'm an architect, but I'm also running a company that I founded. And I founded it on all the principles of, well, if we want our projects to be this way, how do we have to structure the company to enable that?
So how did you do that? How is the business structured?
Well, it's modeled a lot after integrated project delivery. So, for instance, when you want a builder and an architect to coordinate well with each other, you really need to give them a carrot and a stick. And so you reward them for coordinating, but you also punish them for fighting by pooling their profits together. And so that if one loses, they both lose, right? So that's based on a couple of principles, and one of them is shared ownership, that when a group of people share ownership over an idea, they will cooperate better. So my company employs that idea. So my company is an employee-owned company, therefore using the shared ownership idea. But you can't really have people sharing ownership unless they trust each other. And trust comes from transparency. And so my company operates as a transparent business model, meaning that all of us discuss by consensus what the direction of the company will be, how we're going to get there, and what we're going to pay ourselves, and what kind of clients we're going to go after. And all of those major decisions are discussed by consensus so that the transparency fosters the trust, which enables us to work together as shared owners.
And then does everyone have equal ownership, or are there levels of ownership?
No, everyone does not have equal ownership. I founded the company myself with my own funds and my own sweat equity. So I have the lion's share of the ownership. And also, unfortunately, you actually have to be a licensed architect in California to own part of a corporation. So I have three employees right now in addition to myself. Two of them are on track for ownership, meaning that I have offered ownership to them and they have accepted and they have been earning small amounts of ownership, but I can't officially give them ownership until they get licensed.
Okay.
So in spirit, they're owners, but not legally yet.
So they're functioning as partners, just not legally partners.
Yeah. I own about 82% of the company. They both own about less than 1% right now. And then the rest is unissued stock.
So did you structured the business in a similar structure to the integrated project delivery, right? I mean, was that the inspiration or is it just a coincidence that your talents kind of lie in that integrated idea and that's how it worked out?
No, it's not a coincidence at all. I looked at all of the principles of integrated project delivery and asked how I could apply that to a company-wide level.
Yeah, that is so interesting. Because the structure that you described originally of the mismanaged sort of non-structured company is pretty typical in the architectural profession. That's pretty much how most firms are structured.
Yeah, I don't think the firm I was working for is particularly worse than any other. It's just that's what they are.
So do you have any... So you have this integrated company, this employee-owned company. Is the actual physical structure of the business different as well?
Yeah. So a lot of architects start their own companies and they're solopreneurs. It's just them working out of their kitchens. So it's kind of like that, the same idea in that we work from home most of the time. And then we have office space on Thursdays in which we spend all day together face to face. And we sublet space from an engineering firm. We get a conference room from them so that we're all around the same table so that when we are coordinating and collaborating, we're doing that in one room. But then the rest of the time we're working independently. And we've experimented with having the office space 2 days a week and 1 day a week. And we've, you know, right now we've determined that 1 day a week seems to be working, but we may go back to 2 days a week. It kind of depends on who's in your company at any given time. So there are three of us who are kind of all on the same professional level, meaning we're very self-directed. And so having 1 day a week together works really well. But there's one who's more junior in her career and she seems like she needs more face-to-face time. And so you have to kind of gauge that in any given company. But otherwise, you know, keeping the overhead as low as possible, working from home really seems to work for us.
So your daily offices are all at home, and then you have a shared space that you sublet from an engineering firm.
Yeah, and we use Skype and texting and, you know, GChat and all of that to keep in touch throughout the rest of the week.
Yeah, so that was actually my next question is how is the communication on a daily basis, how does that work?
So we use all those forms of communication. We call when things are more complex. We just need to talk something out on the phone. Our servers are based on Dropbox. So we have everything's in the cloud. All our accounting information is in the cloud. All our software is cloud-based, except for Revit, of course, which lives on the individual machines. So that's how we make it work. We have a web-based project wiki, I guess you could call it, or like an electronic bulletin board we use called Podio, and that helps us keep track of everything. So it's really not hard in this day and age.
Yeah. So could you imagine, because I mean, it's since you meet once a week, you are all local to one another.
Mm-hmm.
Could you imagine that this same structure could work without that physical meeting once a week where it would happen virtually?
I don't want to say for sure. I mean, I don't think it would work very well just because there's something elusive about a face-to-face meeting. But, you know, maybe somebody can prove me wrong. I don't know.
Right. But so you feel that there's a really strong value to meeting in person once a week?
Yes. I also feel there's a very strong value in having plenty of alone time to work where you're not interrupted by other people too.
Right, right. How do you work with, you know, sort of the administrative ends of things where, you know, a typical office would have a receptionist and a mm-hmm. someone answering the telephone. How does that work for you?
Sure. We use a service called Grasshopper. And so when people call our business line, there's a recorded voice that says, please press 1 for OSHA, or I think it's extension 700, you know, 701 for Jeffrey, 702 for Oswald, whatever it is. And they have professional actors recording, you know, so that you have a very professional greeting. You can have any greeting you want. So we use that instead of a receptionist.
And so that's really the only other, well, what about like things like, I guess existing conditions in the actual meetings at the buildings would happen similar to your physical meetings. You would just, because you're local, you can all just meet at the site.
Yeah. I mean, that is the thing about architecture is you're somewhat tethered to, you can only be as far away as you can drive to the job site. And, you know, I thought that it was going to be maybe harder with potential clients wanting to meet at an office, but it just hasn't come up. I mean, seems like most of the time the client wants to meet on the job site or in their office to discuss it.
Yeah, I think that's a great lesson to learn. Actually, when I opened my firm, Anne Marie and I kind of, you know, built out this 2,000 square feet of office space, designed a conference room, designed a reception room, when it was just the two of us and we had planned to grow into it. And we never grew into it, and we never had clients actually ever come to the office, because we go to their projects. And so we spent a lot of money and a lot of time on something we never even used. So I think people who are considering starting their own firm, whether it's a physical, office traditional structure or an integrated structure like you're talking about, or virtual, do you call it a virtual structure? What do you call that?
A distributed model.
Distributed model.
There's one other thing too, and this depends highly on the area in which you're operating, but we also use a co-working space periodically. And so for people who don't know what that is, it's just a big shared office, and you can drop in whenever you feel like it, sit wherever there's space, and they have Wi-Fi and, you know, coffee and electricity and all that. They have a lot of them in the Bay Area. We use one called Next Space that I like a lot. And I just give day passes. They're like $25 a day pass. And I give a handful to each of my employees so that if on an as-needed basis they need to meet with a client downtown or they need to meet with each other and collaborate on something, they can meet up at any one of the several locations that they have. And then it's not a big deal that we don't have office space that day.
That's a great idea, great tip. Did you start, because I think when your name first kind of appeared on my radar, I think that there was an article in one of the journals about you and your new firm. And did you start with a shared office space like that, or?
Yeah. Well, actually, we very first started with meeting in Gary's kitchen. That was our first office. And Gary was an advisor, and he was the first person I sought out when I started the firm, because I was very young to be starting a firm. I think I was 29 when I started on this journey. And I reached out to him as a mentor. I'd worked under him at a different firm and told him my vision, and he was really interested in helping me. And he had run a firm before for 20 years. And so he took me under his wing and taught me things like how to, you know, do proposals and how to approach potential clients, and how to estimate fees and stuff. And we would meet in his office or his kitchen every Saturday for a long time. And then when we outgrew him because we got bigger and more experienced, that's when we switched to the co-working space.
Got it. And then so you actually, you met at the co-work? I mean, you worked on a daily basis at the co-working space originally, correct?
Not daily. We still worked from home.
Okay.
But we met a couple times, and the challenge that we found, this is why we switched to getting subleasing a conference space from an engineering firm. The challenge for us was that, you know, there were four of us or three of us some days, and we were all talking stuff out and like doing the consensus thing, which gets a little loud sometimes.
Yeah.
And here were all these coders with their headphones, like trying to write code, and it just wasn't working all that well. So we needed kind of a quieter space for those days.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. I love what you're doing. I think it's it's the future of architecture firms. Even my firm, you know, as the economy started to weaken, we shrunk. We didn't fire anybody, but people kind of along through the years moved on, and we didn't replace them. And so we've significantly shrunk in the number of people working with us. And so now we're getting busy again. And so we haven't announced this to anybody, but we're considering, and I may have announced it by the time this podcast goes live, that that we're not going to grow physically, that we're probably going to shrink physically and then go virtual as far as hiring people and work with other architects, mm-hmm. you know, either locally or not so locally, and work through the internet and use many of the same tools you're using to kind of grow as much as we need and be more flexible.
Yeah, there's a guy that I work with occasionally for BIM services when I get too busy, and he's not local, he's in Reading, and I think I met him once when I happened to be in Reading, but I've worked with him on and off for years, and he's very reliable. But you know, BIM services was one of those things that they don't need to physically be on site to do.
Right.
And the other one that I use that is totally virtual is my admin assistant. She's not local to me. She's somewhere like on the East Coast somewhere. I don't even know where she is actually.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's great that somebody's so, you know, interconnected and personal with you and knows everything that you're doing and working with you. You don't even know where she physically is. It's awesome. It's a perfect example of the world we're living in today.
Yeah.
So let's shift gears a little bit, because I want to also have a little bit of time to talk about your retreats. I know that you do a retreat for entrepreneurial women. Could you give me a little bit of history about that, those retreats, and how they started and what your plans are for that?
Yeah, sure. When I was starting the company, I was in business school at the same time on nights and weekends, and I thought that I would find a nice community full of other people who are entrepreneurs, and I did not. What I found was that people who go to business school generally are not entrepreneurs. They are going to go work at Hewlett Packard or Apple or, you know, wherever. So I did not find the kind of community there that I was hoping for. So then I looked elsewhere, and I thought for sure there would be lots of stuff for women entrepreneurs. And then fortunately, what I found was there's lots of stuff for women who are in the corporate world, you know, meetings and meetup groups and support for people climbing the corporate ladder who are women. And then there are also lots of things in my area, at least for entrepreneurs, but only if you fit the Silicon Valley model of entrepreneurship, tech, high growth, venture funded. And if you didn't fit those, you know, they're just... you were out on your own. They would tell you to go to the Small Business Association, of course, which is useless. So I decided to make my own community, specifically women entrepreneurs. And so I gathered people and I thought, well, I want to go on a retreat. That sounds like a really good way to dive into some of the issues, both practical and emotional, that come with starting a company as a woman. So I started an annual retreat for women entrepreneurs, and it's a weekend long. And I've done it 2 years in a row, and then we're going to do it again next year. And, you know, I guess I have a lot of lessons learned on that, if you're interested. Primarily is that you cannot get that many people to go away for a whole weekend. that's what I've learned. So the first year we had 40 or 42, I think. And that's really good. Although I think I expected more like 75. And the second year, I made the mistake of putting it on a holiday weekend. So we had 30-something women instead. So that's good to know, because the conversion rate on a retreat is much lower than it would be on some of the other events.
And you said you do it for a weekend or a week?
A weekend.
A weekend. So a Saturday and Sunday?
Yeah, it's Friday night, Saturday, and half of Sunday.
Okay. And what type of facility are you using to do this?
Well, we have it at Asilomar, which is this beautiful historic seaside resort in a nationally protected or a state protected coastal beach. And all of the buildings, well, there are a few modern buildings, but most of the buildings were designed by Julia Morgan, who's the first mm-hmm. woman architect in California. So they're gorgeous. It's on the beach. It's beautiful. They have several conference rooms. We use one with lots and lots of windows and a big fireplace. So yeah, it's gorgeous.
And how is the curriculum, for lack of a better word, structured? How does that work?
We have three keynote speakers who are successful entrepreneurs, and they address the whole group throughout the weekend. And then in between the keynote speakers, we have workshops, which are given by the actual attendees. So it's a peer learning experience. And you'll get to choose, you know, whatever workshops apply to you and your phase of learning at the moment. But what we've been doing, what we did this year, and we'll definitely be doing more of next year, is that we had a theme. So I started up the Friday night talk by giving an overview of structuring a business, which is helpful because then the people sitting through that overview see the parts that they're weak in, right? They say, okay, you know what? I'm pretty good at team management, but I guess I'm weak in this part. So I'll go to the workshops about that. So I give that overview and the theme of what we're going to be talking about for the weekend. And then that helps them follow through, you know, and get something out of it in a thematic way throughout the whole weekend. The other thing is that by the end of it, they should have, all the attendees should have their own business model diagram of their own company filled out.
And they do that while they're at the retreat?
Yes.
That's part of the process.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do you market it? How do people know about it? How do you get 40 people to show up?
So most of the people who come because somebody they know told them about it. So I put the word out to all of the people that I know, and I do that through email. And then we have a Facebook group, and that, I think there are close to 300 people who have liked the Facebook group. So that shows you then again about the conversion rate. And then we advertised on Facebook and got, I think, only 2 attendees from that, but the cost of the advertising was really low. So I think that was probably worth it. I also go in person to a lot of women's events, and I bring a stack of business cards with me when I go to that for the event, and then talk to women one-on-one. And that's the way that I find it, you know, it makes it more personal, and that's how you get conversion.
And what are your goals for the retreat kind of long-term future?
Well, my first goal is to get it to be financially viable. So the first 2 years ran a deficit. As you would expect that the first year, I'd hope the second year wasn't that way, but I think I've learned enough about how to do it that the third year should be in the black, which would be nice. Yeah. But you know, my primary motivation was community. And as I have finished my business school, my master's degree, I have really found that I have a passion for sharing some of that knowledge with women who otherwise are not going to be able to get access to that formal business training, because there's a huge dearth of business understanding among women small business owners. So my long-term goal is to help empower those women who are running businesses, small businesses without formal training, so that they understand that all of this stuff is well within their reach. They're absolutely smart enough to understand how to run a business, how to structure it. And I think that's my bigger goal.
Yeah, that sounds great. We're on similar tracks because my goals are the same for architects.
Good. Yeah.
We need to try to get the architects to understand they're in business.
Yeah, and I wish I knew the exact statistic, but a lot of the small business, small architecture firms are run by women, like disproportionately large number, actually.
Yeah, there's a lot of sole proprietors who choose to be sole proprietors in order to kind of, you know, integrate their life with their business, mm-hmm. Who are women. Yeah. This has been fantastic. Thanks for sharing your knowledge with both Boyle Architecture and the Retreat for Entrepreneurial Women. It's been very interesting.
You're very welcome.
Is there anything else you want to share? Any other ideas or tips that you want to kind of talk about?
Yeah, I would recommend that everybody read this book called Financial Management for Design Professionals by Steve Wintner and Michael Tardif. And I can give you the link to that if that helps with your podcast.
Sure.
But it's a very short book, and it's for architects and engineers and planners. And I found it to be immensely helpful in helping me to understand the financial side of running this business.
That is great. What I'll do is I'll get that from you later, and I'll put it on the show notes, and everybody can go to the show notes for your podcast and all the links to that, as well as all the links to all the different tools that you talked about, will also be there. So,
great.
So we'll have that information.
All right. Thanks, Mark.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Is there any way, any specific place where we can have listeners contact you, either email or on Twitter or any other place where you'd like people to contact you and say thanks and or have any questions?
Yeah, there, I'll direct you to my website because it has all that contact info right on it. And it's boiledarchitecture.com. So boiled like boiling water, B-O-I-L-E-D, architecture.com.
And that reminds me of one more question. Where did the name Boiled Architecture come from?
It is a play off of the phrase hard boiled. So sort of the opposite of the black cape architect who's pretentious and always, you know, does things out of the budget.
Love it. Love it. Well, thank you for being with me today. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Okay. Bye, Mark.
Bye-bye. So I don't know about you, but that, for me, was an awesome episode. I learned so much from Osha. The things that Anne-Marie and I are planning, you know, I spilled a little bit of the beans there in that episode on what we're doing. So we are in the process right now, as I record this, moving our studio from our large 2,000 square foot traditional studio based in Pleasantville, New York. We're moving it to a custom built home studio that we have a space built out in our home where we're moving our studio, and we're going to be working from home. Anne-Marie will continue working from the home studio that she has always worked from. And I will be working in this new home studio that we're in the process of building. I'm sitting in it as we speak, with raw concrete walls and a concrete floor. And it's soon going. Actually, tomorrow, it's going to be framed out and become a real office. So I'm excited. I learned so much from Osha. I thank her very much. And you should stay tuned at the blog and on the podcast for more information on what I'm doing with Five Cat Studio, because I'm going to share everything we're doing. Much of it is an experiment, to see how it works, and I'm going to share all of our successes and all of our failures on the blog and on the podcast with how our restructuring works and what we're going to do, and get into many more details on that. So I look forward to sharing those ideas with you and exploring alternative ways of running an architecture firm. And I've been talking about it a long time, and I'm really excited about the idea of pulling the trigger and taking action and doing it, changing the way we do business in architecture. So stay tuned for all of that. Don't forget to go to the show notes, all the links to all the tips and tools that Osha shared, because she shared many, many tools that she uses to run her firm, as well as that book, Financial Management for Design Professionals. I'll have a link to that as well on the show notes. So make sure you head over to entrearchitect.com/episode10, and you will reach show notes for this show. So that's it for this episode. I do thank you for listening, and I would love for you to go over to iTunes and give us a rating and a review. And thank you very much from the bottom of my heart. I really, truly appreciate that you listen to this podcast and read the blog. These past few weeks have seen tremendous growth at the blog, and I am very humbled, and I love doing what I'm doing, and I thank you very much for being a part of my journey with Entrepreneur Architect, and I am so excited about the future of where we're going with Entrepreneur Architect, and I thank you for taking this journey with me. So until next time, this is the Entrepreneur Architect podcast. My name is Mark R. LePage, and I am an Entrepreneur Architect. Thank you for listening.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
how to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and this sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure. And when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns. What's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glengarry. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.
Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark Arlepage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short-haul frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.